This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Arvind Yuvaraj, and you are listening to Tech Talk. Kaspersky Lab held their third annual cybersecurity weekend for the APAC region in Phuket recently, and I managed to catch up with some very interesting people and some of the top minds who are at the forefront of Kaspersky's ongoing battle against cyber criminals. This year's theme revolved around cyber espionage and the ways that cyber attackers and their methodologies have sort of evolved over the years, and what is being done to counter those threats.
The one who owns the information, who controls the information, owns the world. Because within a matter of day or two, you can become the richest person on Earth, or you can become a poorest person on Earth. You can be hurt or destroyed by information, or you can be victorious with the help of information. Now we live in information age, and information becomes critical. And that's why everybody is participating in this war of information.
This is Vitaly Kamaluk. He is the director of Kaspersky's Global Research and Analysis Team, or GREAT for short. And I managed to catch up with him after his session to get a better understanding of what exactly we are up against in the world of cyber criminals and cyber espionage. So the emergence of cyber criminals, when did this happen and when did it sort of become like a global crisis?
Good question. I think it started somewhere in 2006, 7, 8 with the emerge of botnets and exploit kits. This is when we first have seen fully automated infection of users visiting a website, turning the visitors' machines into zombie machines and then controlling hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands, and in some particular cases, exceptional cases, millions of machines from a single point. This when the criminals realize that there are so many computational network resources that are out there, and then they started looking for a way to monetize it. And the crisis came when we realized that we used to process a couple of hundreds new samples per day in the past. Well, back in the 90s, they were one sample per day, perhaps. And we processed hundreds of samples when I joined the company in 2005. And in 3-4 years, we realized that there are thousands of files coming every day, and then tens of thousands. And it became impossible to process all those files manually by human analysts. We couldn't grow our stuff forever to the infinite space, right? That's why we started investing into technologies that would allow us to automatically recognize malicious behavior based on some similarity to already known samples and so on. This was a breaking point. And that was the moment when we were in doubt, whether we can cope with this volume of data or not. This was a turning point for us. This is when we realized that the level of cybercrime rise so high that it's impossible to process everything manually anymore. I would say these dates were critical.
And how have they evolved over the last year? Because, what's happening today is so drastically different from the types of cyber crimes that happened 10 years ago. So tell us about that evolution, the evolution of the cyber criminal.
It definitely have evolved. They became more organized. And with the appearance of targeted attacks, nation-state-sponsored attacks, which were very surgically precise and very stealth by nature, cybercriminals learned that if they do the same, they can survive longer in the infected systems and they can perhaps even earn more money. So they tried to copy the same techniques and use the same tactics to propagate and steal similar information, which can be then traded on the black market. So they started mimicking and copying these targeted attackers that were originally nation-state sponsored. So now what we see is the change of model of operation of cyber criminals. They are organized groups, they are doing these targeted attacks against those entities that can bring them some money. Usually it's like financial sector, of course. So that's why we see many, many target attacks against banks, investment firms. Sometimes it's cryptocurrency companies and businesses. And they steal bigger money. Instead of stealing like, you know, dollars and cents from the end users, from customers of the banks, they can go directly to the bank and steal millions. So that's the change that we've seen over the last years.
So during your session, you mentioned cyber gangs and entire syndicates that carry out cyber attacks nowadays. So can you tell us about that, like about the operations behind the keyboards and the monitors? Because it's not just one guy anymore. It isn't as simple as it used to be, right? So how complex or how sophisticated are these operations behind these attacks?
Well, it's a good question to Nushin. She actually presented on this matter today. But, well, we see them as a regular engineers, to be honest. They're different. They have different roles. Somebody is talented in software development, so he would create malware. There are people who are talented in vulnerability research. They would look for new vulnerabilities in the products. Or they will try to reverse engineer patches that are applied by vendors, like operating system vendors and other software vendors. They'll try to reverse engineer it, extract what was patched, and they will try to re-implement an exploit that focuses and uses this particular vulnerability, because there will be a lot of people that have not patched their systems yet. So this is what we call one-day exploits, not zero-day exploits. So patch already exists, but certain category of population is reluctant to patch, they disable auto-updating mechanisms, or they just, forget about this, and it still works. And we've seen that even works on serious organizations such as banks. One of the banks, actually not one, but several banks in Europe were breached earlier this year by a serious targeted attacker called Lazarus, just because there was this one-day vulnerability. It was patched like a year ago. A year ago, there was a patch from the vendor, but they could not apply the patch due to certain circumstances. And then they were breached and their infrastructure was used. Well, luckily for them, the operation was interrupted, so we stepped in and helped them with incident response, but it could have happened, and they could have lost potentially millions of dollars within that cyber attack.
So let's say like someone, an individual or like a company, they contact you because they believe that they are under threat of a cyber attack. So they contact you, they contact Kaspersky. What happens after that? Like, what is the process like?
One of our customers, a big bank, contacted us and said, look, we have this suspicious DNS request coming out of one of our servers, and we are not sure whether this is legitimate or not, because it looks pretty long and like randomly looking domains, which are not ours, and we don't know who owns them. So they invited one of our experts to take a look. So the expert looked and said, like, oh, this is spooky, like, let's make a proper forensic procedure here and do analyze like what's the source of it. So he made like a memory dump of the server, took a disk image of the server, if I'm not mistaken, and then we analyzed it in the lab. We found that there was a process that is legitimate from a digitally signed binary that was sending this request. But the question was like, why is it doing so? What we managed to find is that one of the modules was part of the legitimate tool was backdoored, and it was backdoored before it was digitally signed, which means the signature was valid, and administrator could verify that the signature is valid and be like relaxed that it, like, if this is signed, like, there is a certain level of assurance that this must be the vendor and it's legitimate. So what they suspected is that the vendor might be compromised, and they were right. We verified like what was the purpose of this DNS request, and the purpose was to contact with the infrastructure of the bad guy to get the encryption keys and address of the next command and control server to communicate with and download additional modules. So we did that by reverse engineering the code, and since then it became clear that this is a malicious injection. We had to immediately contact the vendor and notify them, because the same distributives were still available from the official website, and they were all backdoored. and we had to somehow break through and contact the software developers or administrators to take it down. And they responded within hours, they took it down. So it was amazing. Still, what were the stages like? First, the customer suspects something spooky, shady, reports to us, we investigate, confirm. Then we tell the customer that we confirm that this is malware, ways to clean their systems, to isolate these compromised assets. And then we get in touch with the vendor to fix the issue, to take it down. And then we continue. This is not the end of our research, because we continue. We want to find who else is infected, to notify those parties, where it is controlled from, who is behind this, what code similarities exist with other malware, to understand who are we dealing with, and so on. And this involves like many, many other stages of the research, which I can speak about separately. But yeah, it's how we work on a daily basis, so to say.
We've got more from Vitaly Kamaluk, head of the team of researchers at Kaspersky Lab, coming up after this very, very short break. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9.
Better Finance Management, BFM 89.9.
You are still listening to Tech Talk. This is Arvind Yuvaraj, and I managed to catch up with Vitaly Kamaluk. He heads the team of researchers at Kaspersky Lab, and I caught up with him during Kaspersky's Cybersecurity Weekend in Phuket. And we are talking about the evolution of cyber attacks. We touched on cyber criminals and what exactly is being done to keep us safe in the virtual world that, you know, nowadays that pretty much dictates the physical world at large. Right. So what do you mean by reverse malware engineering?
Very simple. If you think about engineering as building something, reverse engineering is deconstructing something. So when you have a malware, how do you create malware? People, software developers, engineers, they have to code it in a human-readable language like C++, Java, Microsoft, .NET, and anything else. And then they compile it, if it's compilable, and then it becomes a binary executable, which you can double-click and it will do its job, right? Because the source code, you cannot double-click and run, because it's just a text file. So the executables can run, but they are all built and contain machine understandable code. That's why we call it binary. The CPU, the operating system, they know how to parse it, they know how to understand and interpret this code, but not humans, because it's not human readable anymore. So reverse engineering is conversion from machine code into human readable description of pseudocode, sometimes we call it so, to just understand what it was designed for.
I want to ask you about your job. What's the biggest misconception that people have about your job? Because, so what is the one stereotype that you want to get rid of? Because when you watch movies, you see people who work in these industries, and it's always like a teenager with a hoodie, and he's in a basement. But so what are the things that you want to break about your job?
Well, most stereotypes are coming, I think, from the Hollywood. So whatever you see in the Hollywood normally is... not so true, especially when it comes to hacks. It usually like takes minutes or seconds, like to brute force a password to somehow find a bypass and enter the system to authenticate. In reality, it may take days, months. Sometimes people spend more. So it's not that attractive visually as well, because Hollywood tries to depict like this is like visually, like you can see viruses running here and there. No, we don't see viruses. No, we have to read. It's more like reading books in the library. So every application consists of tens of thousands of lines of text. You can calculate how many pages that would be, like 50,000 lines, for example, would be like perhaps also like a few thousands of pages. And you have to read it from top to bottom, and you have time pressing on you. So you don't have luxury to keep reading as much, as long as you want. You have to do it fast. You have to answer key questions. Like, to provide a summary of a thick book, of a large book, within, hours, maximum days. Like, you have, let's say, a day or two, and you're given a volume of some book, and you have to provide like a summary in few sentences what this book is about. So the challenge is how to provide the summary without reading the whole book, because you don't have time to read the whole book. And this is where experience comes in place and helps, because sometimes specific chapters, specific sentences within chapters can tell you like what the book is about, like the shortened plot and the idea behind a particular volume of a book can be answered within few sentences, and that's what our job is about. It's like reading large books. It's not that shiny as Hollywood shows it.
Let's say someone used to be a black hat hacker, right? Or let's say they worked illegally as a hacker. Is it okay, or is it ethical to hire those guys who maybe they want to change their ways and maybe they want to become white hat hackers? Is it okay to hire them because they have experience in hacking from the other side? Is it okay to hire them now to be the good guys?
And by the way, this is related to another misconception perhaps. Some people actually now read the word hacker as something bad, which is a misconception. Originally, the word was about a smart person that can find a quick solution to a given problem and crack a hard problem with a very easy way. So don't be confused by this as well. Hacker doesn't mean bad. Criminal means bad. Black hat means bad. So answering your question, whether we hire hackers, if you speak about good hackers, those people that can crack solutions like this and they are hard problems, correct problems. We do hire such people. They are talented people. But if they did crime in the past, if we know about it, if we suspect it, we would never hire such people. So it happened in the past when virus writers and Trojan writers came to us and said, look, I created this worm. You know what I mean. Like, I know how it works. So I know a little bit about the malware. So I want to work for a company now. We did not hire those people. More to that, we had to report them to the police. Unfortunately for them, they were very, very angry at us after this. But so we would not take the risk of firing people if we knew that they are black hats. Because one day it may strike back. We don't want to put a stain on our reputation. We want to have trusted people that know how to behave, they know how to control themselves and follow the code of conduct and will never step out of it.
We've heard news of companies like Apple, like Amazon, like Facebook, Uber, I think also for that matter. They are known for protecting user data by never allowing anyone, even the authorities, any access. Do these policies make it tougher for people like you? Or you've done work with Interpol, so does it make it tougher for Interpol to carry out investigations? Or are these companies sort of justified in protecting their users, even if there are criminal charges involved?
Of course it does make it tougher, of course. On the other hand, we all have to respect privacy of other people. We shall not violate this privacy. There is a very thin line, like privacy, once you do it, you know, once for a good reason, it doesn't prevent other people doing it again, but maybe not so good reason. So how can you be sure? Like, you may come with good intentions, but once you open that Pandora box, it can be open for all, and that's bad. So we just have to deal with certain constraints and limitations, like whenever it comes to, let's say, a Facebook account or a mailbox, and we don't have a warrant, We cannot do much. If they're not cooperative, we cannot do much. We just have to find another way. It's pretty much like take a Tor network. So this shall not be crossed. This line has to stay there, and police normally understand that they would give up, you know, pressing on the Tor developers, which happened in the past. They actually openly said that we were asked by police to do so. We refused those offers. And still police managed to catch the criminal. Because the criminal is just a human being. Technology protects him today. Tomorrow he will make a mistake outside of the scope, outside of the environment that he's using. He may mention his name, he may use something, I don't know, personal, that can identify him and give police certain clues where to find the guy. and eventually they will arrest him this way or another without breaking the privacy of all Tor users. So I'm a believer in this solution that we shall not destroy privacy of people. We shall respect this and we'll try to find our, you know, best way to arrest criminals within the constraints that we have to work in.
What can regular people do on a daily basis to, you know, to keep themselves safe from cybercrimes without going into all the, you know, without having any sort of advanced technical knowledge? What can everyday people do to make sure they are not victims of a cyber attack?
For the common users, I would recommend to become a little bit more suspicious. Think about this in the following way. When you travel to a new city that you have never been to, a stranger comes to you in the street and asks you, "Can you come with me? I can show you something really cool." Would you follow the stranger? You probably won't, because you'll be like suspicious and you'll think, like, what does this guy want from me? Is it my money? Is it my mobile phone? Is it anything else? Is it my kidney? Is it anything else? I would be super suspicious if I had this. So the question is, like, why do we trust all these strangers on the internet? It's the same thing. It's not friendly at all. And it's new city every day you go to a new website. So why do you trust all these strangers that invite you to follow this link, open this file, do this and that? Why do you trust these strangers on social networks, social media, on messengers that you are using? Why do you trust all these people? Limit, you know, your trust that you delegate to strangers. Trust your friends, trust your relatives, and make sure that nobody is abusing their name to trick you into something, because that's also possible. So make sure that you are talking to the person you trust, and only then express certain trust.
For more on Vitaly Kamaluk, as well as Kaspersky's efforts at battling cyber threats, just visit great.kaspersky.com. This has been Tech Talk with Arvind Yuvaraj. You can download the podcast via the BFM app, available on the Apple App Store for iOS users and on the Play Store for Android users. And just look up Tech Talk for more podcasts like this. This is BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.